have this cultural violence, this structural violence that is stemmed in misgendering. And I believe the biggest obstacle facing the trans community are points of view that disavow our identities, points of view that suggest that we are always and only the gender we were assigned at birth. As wonderful as I think this country is, it was formed leaving a lot of people out, right? We've had to make amendments to our Constitution because this country was founded on the backs of slaves. Women haven't always had the right to vote. Trans people are systematically and institutionally erased from our country. And these identity politics are really about everybody being included. That's what I think it's about.
That's Laverne Cox, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Laverne Cox on transgender visibility. The LGBTQ, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer community have made significant strides in recent years in achieving legal recognition and protection. But some of the gains are being rolled back. At stake is whether transgendered persons are protected under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and Title IX of the Higher Education Act amendments. One issue is whether transgender individuals have the right to use public school restrooms that match their gender identity. Who would have thought you'd have to make a federal case out of going to the bathroom? The issue pits evolving generational attitudes toward gender nonconformism against a long-standing culture of intolerance. The Trump administration recently revoked federal guidelines that prohibit sex discrimination in state and local school districts that receive federal funds. Resistance to the edict is coalescing as fast as you can say, LGBTQ. Our guest today is Laverne Cox, an actor, documentary film producer, and LGBTQ activist. She stars in the highly acclaimed Netflix series, Orange is the New Black. Her documentary productions include The T-Word and Free CC. She spoke at the University of Colorado at Boulder. And now, Laverne Cox.
I stand here before you this evening, a proud African-American transgender woman. From a working class background, raised by a single mother, I stand before you an artist, an actress, a sister, and a daughter, and I believe it's important to name the various intersecting components of my multiple identities because I am not just one thing, and neither are you. I believe it's important to claim the various intersecting components of my multiple identities with pride in public, because I've not always been able to do so. I've often carried tremendous amounts of shame about various aspects of who I am. And I gotta tell you, folks, if you are a girl or a woman like me, or if you're a transgender person like me, you live in a country that shames you, stigmatizes you, objectifies and criminalizes you. Last year in North Carolina, they passed the so-called bathroom bill, which is still on the books. It's still the law of the land in North Carolina. And this so-called bathroom bill, HB 2, House Bill 2, criminalizes transgender people using the bathroom that is consistent with how we identify. It criminalizes me going to the women's room in the state of North Carolina. And last year, 50 similar bills were introduced in state legislatures all over this country. 50 bills. Earlier this year, Texas introduced a similar bill, SB 6. And just today, South Dakota introduced another bill which would criminalize transgender people using the bathroom that is consistent with our gender identity. According to the National Coalition of Anti-Violence Programs, 2015 was the deadliest year on record for transgender people. No other time were there more homicides recorded than in the year 2015 until the year 2016. The most recorded homicides of transgender people that we know of happened just last year. According to the National U.S. Transgender Survey, the most recent one, the unemployment rate in the transgender community is 3 times the national average, 4 times that for trans people of color. the transgender population, the number of transgender people living in poverty is twice the national average. And 77% of students in grades K through 12 who express a transgender or gender non-conforming identity experience harassment or bullying. 77%. It is a state of emergency for far too many trans people across this nation. But as Dr. Cornel West reminds us, justice is what love looks like in public. That's good, right? Justice is what love looks like in public, and trans and gender non-conforming people can use some justice, some love today. Poor and working people could use some justice, some love today. People of color can use some justice, some love today. Women can use some justice, some love today. Undocumented immigrants can use some justice, some love today. People with disabilities can use some justice, some love today. And ain't I a woman? It is my belief that one of the biggest obstacles facing the transgender community are points of view which disavow our identities, points of view that suggest that no matter what we do, we are always and only the gender we were assigned at birth, points of view that suggest that no matter what I do, I'll never be a woman yet. Ain't I a woman? Ain't I a woman? We've all heard of Sojourner Truth here, yes? Yes? Sojourner Truth, the legendary abolitionist and women's rights activist, made an iconic speech that 12 years later would become known as the Ain't I a Woman speech, although historians suggest that she never uttered that phrase on this fateful day. She made this speech in Akron, Ohio, at the Ohio Women's Convention, and she made this speech, this Ain't I a Woman speech, in the context of a women's liberation struggle that in many ways suggested she wasn't really a woman, wasn't fully a woman because she was Black. She made this speech in a social context that denied her very humanity because she was Black. There's a famous story about Sojourner Truth that I love. Apparently, this legend goes, in 1858, she was giving a speech in Silver Lake, Indiana, and someone yelled from the audience accusing her of being a man, which happened a lot to suffragettes at the time. And Sojourner Truth famously, allegedly, apparently, opened her blouse and revealed her breast. Now, I'm not going to reveal my breast tonight. Sorry to disappoint some of you. But I do stand here this evening claiming my womanhood in a social context which would often deny it. My feminist idol, a woman by the name of Bell Hooks. We've heard of Bell Hooks here, yes? Bell Hooks used the title of the famous Sojourner Truth speech for her first book. She titled it Ain't I a Woman, Black Women and Feminism, and in it she chronicles the historic devaluation of Black womanhood in America. She locates herself in the tradition of Sojourner Truth, and she calls out the history of feminist theory in this country that did not take into consideration race and class when it was talking about womanhood. She and a group of other amazing feminists at the time pushed against essentialist ideas of what it meant to be a woman and really were the founders of intersectionality. Mama Hooks was talking about race, class, and gender over 30 years ago, over 35 years ago to be exact, before it was popular, well, at least in certain circles to do so. And I discovered Bell Hooks' work when I was a gender non-conforming college student in New York City, not unlike many of you here this evening. And Bell Hooks' words were like oxygen to me. I came to critical consciousness reading her books. And there was another feminist theorist whose work really spoke to me when I was a gender non-conforming college student in New York City, and her name is Judith Butler. Have we heard of Judith Butler, some of us here? Good old Judy B. I met her last year for the first time. That was awesome. And there was a specific moment in Judith Butler's iconic book, Gender Trouble. Do we know Gender Trouble, some of us? There's a specific moment in Gender Trouble that really spoke to me. There's a moment in Gender Trouble when Butler is doing a critical analysis of Simone de Beauvoir's famous book, The Second Sex. We know Simone de Beauvoir here, yes? If we don't, look into her major. Simone de Beauvoir famously wrote, "One is not born a woman, but rather becomes one." Now, the first time I read this, I was very, very excited. Even though I wasn't quite ready to claim my own womanhood, this idea of becoming, this idea of existence, preceding essence, was really exciting me, this existential idea about womanhood. And Butler, in her analysis of this moment, writes, nowhere in Du Bois's account is it guaranteed that the one who becomes a woman is necessarily female. Now, I was very, very excited the first time I read this. So one is not born a woman, but rather becomes one. But it is not guaranteed that the one who becomes a woman is necessarily female. And ain't I a woman? Before I began, I was a gender nonconforming college student in New York City. I began becoming in Mobile, Alabama. Is there any South in the house tonight? Yes, my people. And as I said, I was born to a single mother, and I was born exactly 7 minutes before my identical twin brother, so that means I'm older, and I never let him forget it. But that unfortunately means that he's younger, and he never lets me forget that. Yeah, I'm like, it's just 7 minutes, chill. So my mother often had to work two, sometimes three jobs to take care of my brother and me. So we didn't have a lot of material privilege. We were poor, but my mother was a hardworking woman, and she eventually became a teacher. And so education was really important in our household. And my mother made sure that my brother and I were really, highly educated. And she also made sure that we were aware of the rich history we were born into, the rich history of racial oppression. We were born into being born in the state of Alabama. My mother was born in the Jim Crow South and told us all these stories about what it was like for her growing up in Alabama in the Jim Crow South. And so before I knew anything about myself, I knew that I was Black. Now, when I started interacting with other kids in school, I was greeted with words like sissy, words like the F word that's a synonym for sissy that I don't like to say. It ends with a G sometimes. It's a different form of it, a plural form of it that I don't like to say. And even before I even knew what these words meant, I was being called them in preschool. And from about preschool all the way until high school, I was bullied practically every single day. I was chased home by groups of kids who wanted to beat me up. I was called names. I was taunted. And when I think about the bullying that I experienced as a kid, I think about a number of things. First of all, I think that it is curious that anti-gay slurs were used to bully me, but I was really being bullied because of my gender expression. I didn't act the ways in which someone assigned male at birth was supposed to act, according to the other kids. They said I acted like a girl, whatever that means, because we know girls act all sorts of ways, right? And I think if we are really serious about ending the bullying of our youth, particularly our LGBTQ youth, we have to begin to imagine what it would mean to create spaces of gender self-determination for all of our kids. Now, the flawed logic of the gender binary model basically states that if one is born with a penis, they should be masculine and attracted to women. If one is born with a vagina, they should be feminine and attracted to men. But we know the realities of our lives defy this binary, defy this conflation of sexual orientation and gender identity. And two, the reality of this gender binary model is that it's very much is something that we do engage in each and every day of our lives through gender policing, but this is something that is also institutionalized. The very idea of male and female bathrooms is a really good example of how this gender binary model is institutionalized. And this institutional model, gender binary model, effectively erases those people who exist in between and beyond that binary. And I often like to imagine what it would be like for a day, a week, a month, or a year, if we can begin to change those systems, if we can begin to not act as the gender police in our own lives. So often, we are called upon to be agents of that state that institutionally erases trans and gender nonconforming people, and we often police gender ourselves. And so I'd like to imagine what it would be like for a day, a week, a month, or a year if each of us decides that we're not going to be the gender police today, if we're going to allow people to express their gender in ways that feel most authentic to them, if we begin to do the work to dismantle the systems that erase transgender nonconforming people. One way to do it, and a bill was introduced into Congress last year, but we know how that goes. Bills just kind of go there and die. But the bill is called the LGBT Data Inclusion Act, and that bill would require federal governmental agencies to ask gender identity and sexual orientation questions, because we actually don't now. All the data we have about trans people, about LGBT people, is from surveys that organizations do and from guesstimations that organizations like the Williams Institute does. So we actually don't have an accurate count of how many trans people are in the United States. We have a guesstimation, but we don't ask the question. That is one example of how systemically, on an institutional level, we erase transgender people. But I gotta tell you, I'm here. We are here, and we would love to be counted. Another thing I think about when I think about the bullying that I experienced as a young person is my mother's reaction to it. When I would tell my mother what the kids were saying and doing to me at school, and when she would find out on her own, she would often say to me, "What are you doing to make them treat you that way?" And so she made me feel as if it were my fault, as if there was something I was doing. Now, I was just being myself. I was just acting in ways that felt most authentic to me. So it was my mother's reaction was the beginning of me internalizing a tremendous amount of shame about who I was. And anyone who knows me knows that when I talk about shame, I love to allude to Brené Brown's work on the subject. It's really, her work is, I feel like, is so groundbreaking on shame. Brené Brown is a qualitative researcher who studies shame, vulnerability, etc. But those are her main areas of study. And Brown defines shame as the intensely painful belief that one is unlovable, that one is unworthy of connection and belonging. Shame functions, she says, in two ways. The tapes that sort of drive shame are never enough, or who do you think you are? She tells us that guilt is, I did something wrong. It's a focus on behavior. And shame is, I am wrong. It's a focus on self. And so from a very early age, I began to feel on a core level that there was something deeply wrong with me, that I was wrong. John Bradshaw calls it toxic shame. And so I didn't feel fully safe at school, and I didn't feel fully safe at home, but where I did feel safe was in my imagination. I loved to dance as a kid, and I was pretty good at it, if I must say so myself. I was really good at looking at choreography on television and imitating it perfectly. And from about the age of 5 years old till third grade, I begged my mother to put me into dance classes. And finally, when I was in third grade, my mother found a program for me where I could take dance classes for free, because we didn't have a lot of money. And so once a week, I got to go and study the thing that I loved to do most. And I really believe, because I had something that I loved to do as a kid, something that I was passionate about, that saved my life. I believe if we can find something in this world that we are truly passionate about, it can be life-saving. But there was a compromise. My mother told me that if I could take dance classes, but I could only take tap and jazz, but not ballet. Ballet, she said, was too gay. I'm not entirely sure what her logic was. Maybe it was something about the tights or something. I'm not sure, but I didn't care, because I got to do what I loved to do most. Now, third grade was the grade where another pivotal moment in my childhood happened, and some of you know this, who know my story, have heard this before. The pivotal moment happened one day when my third grade teacher, Ms. Ridgway, called my mother on the phone and said, "Your son is going to end up in New Orleans wearing a dress if we don't get him into therapy right away." Yes, this really happened. And some of you have heard this before, but what you might not know is the inciting incident which led to the call to my mother. So we had gone to Six Flags on a church trip. More about the church later. We had gone to Six Flags on a church trip, and I remember being at Six Flags and going into the gift shop, and I had a very little bit of spending money. And the moment I walked into the crowded gift shop at Six Flags, there it was. I saw it there hanging, a handheld fan. It had peacocks on it. It was fabulous. And the moment I saw this handheld fan, I knew I had to have it. Now, what you should know about this is I'd seen Gone with the Wind a few weeks before this. And for those of you who don't know, the heroine of Gone with the Wind, Scarlett O'Hara, very famously and glamorously fans herself with a handheld fan. And I was from the Black Church of the South, and so, you know, Black women in the South also fan themselves very much like Scarlett O'Hara with a handheld fan. So I'm sitting in third grade, fanning myself, fanning away, feeling very Scarlett O'Hara, feeling very Gone with the Wind, fabulous. And Miss Ridgway says, "Come here and bring that thing with you." And then Miss Ridgway marches me down the hallway to Miss Fairley's classroom. Miss Fairley was the fifth grade teacher, and she says to me, "Show her what you were doing with that thing." And I'm like, "Yeah." I start fanning away, my invisible hair blowing in the wind. She's like, "Okay, stop. Now go back to class." And then my mother got the call, and my life. And then my mother got the call, and when I look back on this moment from my childhood, I think it's another moment, of course, when my gender was being policed, my gender expression was being policed. When I look back, I think it's kind of adorable, right, that this 30-year-old kid would fan themselves like Scarlett O'Hara. It's kind of fabulous, right? But it was something that I was deeply shamed about. And so I remember sitting in the therapist's office. So, yeah, I actually was taken to a therapist because of this to fix me. And I remember sitting in the therapist's office, and the therapist asked me if I knew the difference between a boy and a girl. And in my infinite wisdom as a third grader, I said, "There is no difference." Now, this is years before Judith Butler, any kind of gender theory. Could you imagine a third grader reading Judith Butler? I guess it happens. But this is years before all of that. But the way I reasoned in my mind is that everyone was telling me that I was a boy, but I knew that I was a girl. I knew in my heart, in my soul, in my spirit that I was a girl. So I reasoned that there must not be any difference. So I watched a lot of television as a kid, and on television, I had heard about this thing called doctor-patient privilege. And so I'd assumed that everything I said to the therapist was between me and the therapist. Apparently, third graders do not have doctor-patient privilege. And so everything I said to the therapist, my mother found out about. And my mother yelled at me when she found out. She was like, "You know the difference between a boy and a girl. A boy is this and a girl is this, and you can't act this way. And people are talking, and what are people saying?" You know, in a small town, it's always about what people are saying. And it was a moment when I just felt so horrible about who I was. And it's really, really painful. My mom and I are cool. We're going to talk more about that later. We're cool now, but it was such an intense moment in my childhood. And what was deep is that my brother was witnessing all this. So all of the gender policing that was going on with me, even though it wasn't going on with him, he was getting the message that he had to behave or he would be made fun of, carted off to the therapist. It was really deep. He and I talked about this years later. One other thing I'll say about the therapist is that I continued to go to the therapist, and eventually the therapist suggested to my mother that they inject me with testosterone to make me more masculine. And I know, right? But luckily for me, a red flag went up for my mother. Something didn't seem quite right to her about injecting her third grader with testosterone before I'd even hit puberty to make me more masculine. So the therapy was discontinued, but the damage was done. So we were members of Bethel African Methodist Episcopal Church. Does anyone know the AME church here? Yeah? Cool. For those of you who don't know, the AME Church, the African Methodist Episcopal Church, is the oldest all-black denomination in the United States. It was started in around 1794 by a dude named Richard Allen and several of his colleagues in Philadelphia. And we were members of Bethel AME Church in Mobile, Alabama. And going to church every single Sunday was pretty much mandatory. I was very active in the church as a young person. I sang in the choir. I was an usher in church, and I was always one of those kids getting up and making speeches. So apparently not much has changed. Full circle. But church was another place where I learned that who I was not only something I would be shamed for, but something that was a sin, something that meant I would go to hell and rot in eternal damnation. Pretty serious stuff. When I was in sixth grade, something life-changing happened for me. And it happened when my dear sweet grandmother passed away. My grandmother was a remarkable woman. Her name was Emma Cox. And she basically raised 10 kids by herself. My grandfather had some issues. So my grandmother did raise 10 kids by herself. She could not read or write, and she worked as a domestic worker. So she cooked and cleaned in the homes of white folks in the segregated South. But she was this extremely elegant woman who always was turned out and looked amazing. And I remember she wore tons of loose powder, and I would sit at her vanity and like play in her loose powder. I like still live for loose powder. And when she passed away, it was a very difficult moment for me and my family. And I remember being up late one night. I lay in bed and I imagined that my grandmother was up in heaven looking down on me. And I imagined she knew every single thought that I was having. And I imagined that she was extremely disappointed in me. So by this time, I had started to go through puberty, and I would often go to sleep and pray. As puberty was starting, I would pray that I would wake up and not turn into a man, that I would wake up and somehow I would be the girl that I was supposed to be. But puberty happened, and as puberty happened, I realized that I was attracted exclusively to boys, and everyone was telling me I was a boy, and I was like, okay, whatever. And so I learned in church that this was a horrible, colossal sin that I was attracted to boys. And so this one night, I imagined that my grandmother was up in heaven, and she knew that I was having these thoughts, these feelings about boys. And I learned in church that if you even have a sinful thought, that you could go to hell and rot in eternal damnation. And so I imagined that she was looking down on me and that she was extremely disappointed in what I was thinking. And the thought of disappointing her made me not want to live. And so I went to our medicine cabinet and I took an entire bottle of pills and I swallowed them and went to sleep hoping not to wake up. I did wake up the next day, thank God, with a terrible stomach ache. But I remember when I woke up, I remember saying to myself that I would do everything that I could to push down those thoughts that I was having about boys. I would do everything I could to act the way that I was supposed to, so I could make my grandmother proud, so I could make everybody proud. And I think it's important to note that 40% of all transgender people report having attempted suicide. 40%. And 50% of trans young people report having attempted suicide. I'm one of those people. So when I was in middle school, I was an overachiever. I was a straight-A student, member of the National Junior Honor Society, et cetera, et cetera. And I heard about this school in Birmingham, Alabama. And the moment I heard about this school in Birmingham, Alabama, I knew I had to go there. And the school is called the Alabama School of Fine Arts, ASFA for short. Back in the 1980s, there was a television show called Fame. Does anybody know this show called Fame? It was kind of Glee, like a couple decades before Glee. And for those of you who don't know, Fame was set in New York City at the High School for Performing Arts. And every 10 minutes or so, the kids of the Fame School would break out into song and dance, and they would sing and dance down the hallways of the school. They would dance on the tables in the cafeteria. They would take these dance numbers out into the street and dance in the hoods of taxi cabs. It was fabulous. And so when I found out there was a fine arts school in my home state, I knew I had to go there, be a dance major, and dance on the tables just like they did on Fame. But when I found out about the dance department at the Alabama School of Fine Arts, I found out it was a ballet-only program. So there was no tap or jazz, and I had never studied ballet before, because if you remember, my mother thought that was too gay. And I was like, well, I don't think I'd be able to get in and get a scholarship if I've never studied ballet before. So what am I going to do? I have to go to this school. So I had been writing a lot at the time, poetry and short stories. And so I said I could submit myself as a creative writing major, get in, get a scholarship, start studying ballet, and then switch my major to dance. And that's exactly what I did. But I got to tell you, I was extremely disappointed when I got to the Alabama School of Fine Arts and discovered that the kids did not dance on the tables like they did on Fame. I tried to get it started a few times. It did not go well. Everybody was like, you're in creative writing. Why are you always dancing? Yes, I got bullied at art school, yeah. But look at me now. Success is the best revenge. Remember that, kids. There were a lot.
You're listening to Laverne Cox on Transgender Visibility. This is Independent Alternative Radio. You can order copies of this program by calling 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
There were a lot of incredible things about the Alabama School of Fine Arts. My love and appreciation for all of the artistic disciplines developed when I was at ASFA. My love for opera that I have to this day. I discovered when I was at the Alabama School of Fine Arts. Up until that point, I had been bullied and shamed for my gender expression, mostly my gender expression and sexual orientation. But when I got to the Alabama School of Fine Arts, I added race and class to the list of things I also was shamed about and was stigmatized for. So my brother and I were two of three black kids in the dorms at the Alabama School of Fine Arts. So there's one other black kid in the dorms besides us. So not only was I going to school with mostly white kids from pretty affluent backgrounds, I was also living 24/7 with mostly white kids from very affluent backgrounds. And so they had this material access and privilege that I didn't have, and I internalized all these feelings of being less than because I didn't have the same things that they did. And I remember being sort of shamed because I didn't have those things, and I was very sort of defiant about all that. And I also experienced being called a racial slur for the very first time my freshman year. It was someone I thought who was a friend, and it was really, really painful. I won't say what they said. It was pretty horrific. And when I think about this part of my story and the shame I internalized about race and class, I can't help but think about my brother. So my brother, my twin brother, was also at the Alabama School of Fine Arts. He was a visual arts major. And I think it is really curious that identical twins can grow up in the same households, go to the same schools, and have completely different experiences. A little bit about my brother. People often ask me when they ask me, find out I have a twin brother, they say, is he gay? Is he straight? Is he trans? How does he identify? So I asked my brother many years ago, what would you like me to say when people ask me about you? And he said, you can say I'm a practicing homosexual because I prefer the idea of practiced orientation and the term gay is a white bourgeois construct. Now, those are my brother's words, not mine. I'm just reflecting how he wants to be identified. And in the spirit of intersectionality, my brother also identifies as punk rock, as Negro goth, and as a free black man. My brother's pretty awesome. And so in the punk rock tradition, my brother wasn't having any of that internalizing shame about race, class, or gender, and any of that stuff. And when I think about this part of my story, again, I can't help but think about what Brené Brown says about shame. One of the things that she says is that two people can experience shame in very different ways and have different shame triggers. And in addition to studying shame, she studies humiliation, embarrassment, and the other self-conscious affects. And so her work is really, really fascinating. There's this one story that she tells, or basically, I think it was a third grade classroom. A teacher says, I have some papers here, and I have a paper without a name. Who has a paper? Who does not have a paper? And then eventually they find out that, you know, she says, for example, Chrissy. Chrissy doesn't have a paper. And the teacher says, I'll give you a name. Stupid, that's your name. So this actually happened in her research. Now, if Chrissy experiences this as humiliation, her self-talk will be something like, I didn't deserve that. That teacher shouldn't have spoken to me that way. I'm not stupid. But if Chrissy experiences this as shame, her self-talk will be something like, yeah, I am stupid. I deserved that. And what Brown found in her work is that humiliation is far more adaptive of the self-conscious affects than shame. She says that shame is linked to addiction, depression, suicide, all these things that keep us from living our best life. And so when I think about my own story, I can't help but think about how my brother experienced his reality as opposed to all the shame that I was internalizing. Now, another great thing about being at the Alabama School of Fine Arts for me is that I was finally away from my mother. I love my mother, but you know how it is. Finally, I got to really experiment with how I dressed. Now, even though I was trying to push down my gender and sexuality, my femininity could not be contained. And when I was away from my mom, I became a frequent customer of the Goodwill and Salvation Army thrift shops. For very little money, I started buying women's and girls' clothes for the first time. Now, I was terrified of wearing a dress or a skirt because I didn't want to end up in New Orleans wearing a dress the way Ms. Ridgway had predicted. So I was a huge fan of culottes and wide-legged bell-bottoms. Every time I saw some culottes or some bell-bottoms, I would get them at the Salvation Army, and they were very cheap at the time. I remember I had this pair of polyester leopard print bell-bottoms. They were so huge that they sort of pulled on the floor behind me, and they were 99 cents at the Salvation Army. It's amazing, right? 99 cents. And now this particular pair of polyester leopard print bell bottoms started out as a jumpsuit. So I remember I cut the top of the jumpsuit off, and so they became pants. And I was often making little alterations in my Salvation Army find. So I would call it my Salvation Army couture. Salvation Armani, if you will. And I had a shaved head at the time, and so I began to exist in a kind of gender non-conforming space, and I started wearing makeup in high school. So I would have my culottes or my wide leg bell bottoms and my shaved head and my you know, little beat going every day, every other day. And so I was in this kind of gender non-conforming, non-binary gender space in high school. So I graduated from the Alabama School of Fine Arts as a dance major, and then I got into Indiana University and a couple other schools, but I ended up going to Indiana University at Bloomington with a dance and an academic scholarship. Thank you very much. I'm proud of that. And I was a straight-A student at IU Bloomington, but I knew I needed to be somewhere else. And so after 2 years of being at IU Bloomington, I transferred to Marymount Manhattan College. And finally, I was in New York City! I say it like that because New York City, for me, represented the place, the space of ultimate possibility, not only for my career aspirations, but also in my search to become more myself. So I continued to be a pretty good student at Marymount. I did plays in the drama department. I danced in the dance department. I started acting when I was at Marymount. But a huge part of my education happened in the nightclub scene of New York City. It was sort of the heyday of the club kid. It was back in the day. God, I don't want to say the decade. Giving away my age. But has anyone seen or heard of a movie called Party Monster? Party Monster is not the greatest movie ever, but it kind of gives you an idea of what the New York City club scene was like at that period. It was back in the 90s, and there was actually a documentary also called Party Monster that sort of chronicles this time period, and it was really the age of the club kid. And club kids were basically folks who dressed up outrageously. They were often very young people, teenagers usually, who dressed outrageously and went out to nightclubs and got paid to party. A lot of them basically got paid to sort of be atmosphere at clubs to go dance or promote parties and dress in all this outrageous drag and sort of performance art pieces that they would wear, and it was fabulous. So when I arrived in New York City in my gender nonconformity and my Salvation Armani and went to the hottest nightclubs in the city, it was an incredible experience. So this was the age of the mega clubs. So the clubs at the time would be 4 or 5 floors. They would be these huge clubs, and there would usually be lines around the corner to get into them. There's a documentary on YouTube about Peter Gation that kind of talks about this period in New York City as well. And so people would have to wait for a very long time to get into these clubs. So I went there, and I was like, I think I look cute. And I went right up to the velvet ropes, and I would stand there. And I was like, hi, how are you? And they would look at me, and they would say, come right in. I didn't have to wait. And they would give me free admittance. I didn't have to pay. They would give me drink tickets so I could drink for free. I didn't even drink at the time. I'd give the drink tickets to my friends. And it was the first time in my life that my gender expression was looked upon as something that was valuable, that made me special, that meant I should, skip ahead of the line. And it was awesome. And some of the people that I would meet in the club scene of New York City would change my life. And there was a particular person who went by the name of Tina Sparkles. I love that name, Tina Sparkles. And boy, did she ever. I met Tina at this nightclub called Webster Hall, which still exists in New York City if you want to check it out. And back in the day, there was a party on Friday nights, and I remember I was powdering my nose up in the balcony at Webster Hall, and Tina asked to borrow my powder. She had forgotten her powder that night, and we became friends, not super close friends, but whenever I would go out, I would see her, and we would talk. Now, a bit about Tina. She was African-American. Actually, she probably still is. Tina is African-American. She was about 6'5", 6'6", in heels. And the night I met her, she was wearing this big, huge Diana Ross hair, which she often wore at the time. And she had this very noticeably kind of pimply, acne skin. She was a beautiful, beautiful queen, statuesque queen. And over the next several years of knowing Tina Sparkles, I watched her transform. I watched her transition from a beautiful, statuesque queen with kind of pimply skin to a flawless, elegant, beautiful woman with flawless skin. Thank you very much. And I remember saying to myself, if Tina can do this, what can I do? And if it weren't for Tina Sparkles and all of the incredible trans women I met in the nightclub scene of New York City, legendary, legendary girls, I might not have ended up at Dr. Risch's office oh so many years ago for my first hormone shot in the beginning of my medical transition. Now, when I arrived in New York City, I had so many misconceptions about who transgender people were based on what I had seen in the media, based on the fear of God that was put in me by my mother, Miss Ridgway, around ending up in New Orleans wearing a dress. I didn't associate being transgender with being successful and accomplished, and I was being groomed to be a successful, accomplished young person. Trans people can internalize the same kinds of transphobia that everybody else receives in this world, just like black folks can internalize racism, just like women can internalize misogyny. And I certainly internalized all those things. But when I moved to New York and got to know trans people, got to know them as people, eventually all those misconceptions about who I thought transgender people were melted away. And I was able to accept those amazing trans people, and eventually I was able to accept myself. And I think that can be the journey for each and every one of us. If we have misconceptions about people who are different from us, I believe if we just get to know them as people, all of those misconceptions will melt away. Now, I imagine my transition would go a little bit like Tina's, that 2 or 3 years into my transition, I'd be able to walk down the street and no one would ever know that I was transgender and I could live as the woman I was always meant to be and be happy, healthy, and free. 2, 3 years into my transition, this wasn't quite happening. 4, 5, 6 years into my transition, this wasn't happening. I would still walk down the street and I would get spooked. Now, spooked is a colloquialism, particularly in the trans community in New York City, which denotes that someone can look at you and just by looking at you can tell that you're transgender. Other parts of the country, trans folks say clocked, but since I still sort of live in New York, I'm in LA and New York now, I still say spooked because that's my history. And when people would spook me on the street, they wouldn't say, "I think that's a transgender woman over there." That wouldn't be what they would say, no. They would usually say something like, "That's a man. Oh, that's a man right there. What? That's a man." Something like that. I say it like that, sort of making fun of it. Marginalized people, often when we make fun of things that can be really oppressive, discriminatory, and hurtful. But the reality is that this is really not a laughing matter. And I've been saying this for years, that I believe that calling a transgender woman a man, that misgendering a trans person, is an act of violence. And when I say that, I'm referring to, do we know Johann Galtung's theory of cultural violence? That's really what I'm talking about. He has a theory of a triangle of violence. At the bottom of the triangle is cultural violence on the left side and structural violence on the right. And at the apex of the triangle is direct violence. And he contends that direct violence stems from cultural violence, attitudes that we have from religion, from art, from different cultural mores that cause people to basically be discriminated against and their life chances to be diminished. So I believe from that theory and from my own empirical experience that calling a transgender woman a man, misgendering a trans person, is an act of violence. And so many times when this happened to me, there was always an undertone of a threat. There was this one particular moment that happened in the spring of 2008. I remember I was walking in my neighborhood at the time in Midtown Manhattan. I remember I was listening to Beyonce on my headphones. The song specifically was Upgrade You. And so I was in my own world, and I was feeling it, and, you know, I was like, ew, Papa, let me upgrade you. I'm a happy as a D-boy. So I'm listening to Upgrade You, but then I see this group of young men sort of approaching. I'm approaching this group of young men, so I kind of turn my music down just to become more aware. In New York, you have to be very aware of your surroundings. And as I turned my music down, I heard anti-gay slurs. I heard anti-trans slurs. I heard one of them yell, "That's a man," and then one of them kicked me. And I remember being stunned for a moment. I was like, did this just really happen to me? And then I immediately retreated into a nearby store and called the police. I was scared, but for some reason I stayed pretty calm. And by the time the police had gotten there, the perpetrators had left the scene. And I'm happy to report I had a pretty decent experience with the police that day. Often trans people can't report that. Over 50% of us don't feel safe reporting being victims or survivors of crime to the police, but I had a decent experience with the police that day, and it felt empowering to say to them and say to the world that I do not deserve to be treated this way. And that is the worst of the physical violence I've experienced, at least as an adult. I experienced much worse physical violence as a kid that we don't have time to go into today, but I feel very lucky that that is the worst of what's happened to me as an adult, because for far too many trans people, particularly trans women of color, they're not so lucky. On August 17th, 2013, a young woman by the name of Elan Nettles was walking down the street in Harlem, New York. She was a beautiful 21-year-old African-American transgender woman. She was walking with a friend of hers, and she was catcalled by a group of young men. And as she, one particular young man, his name was Julius Dixon, was, you know, trying to talk to her and trying to, you know, sort of hit on her. And then his friends started to taunt him, basically suggesting that Elan was transgender. And then as he was being taunted by his friends, he recounted in his testimony that he then asked her if she was a man. And before she could answer, he punched her in the face, and she fell to the ground, and he continued to punch and kick her. By the time the police arrived on the scene, this happened across the street from a police precinct, by the way, Elan Nettles was rushed to the hospital, and she was basically pronounced brain dead that night. He had bashed her head into the sidewalk. So 5 days later, her mother, Dolores Nettles, had to make the very difficult decision to take her off of life support. Now, Julius Dixon pled guilty last year to manslaughter, is now serving 12 years for the murder of Elan Nettles. I mention her story because, again, we have this cultural violence, this structural violence that is stemmed in misgendering. And as I said earlier, I believe the biggest obstacle facing the trans community are points of view that disavow our identities, points of view that suggest that we are always and only the gender we were assigned at birth. When Dixon, who was attracted to her because she's a woman, then said that she was a man, that disavowal of her identity that led to this violence that killed her is the kind of violence that seeks to erase transgender people every single day in this country. My friend Chase Strangio, who works for the ACLU and is defending a young man named Gavin Grimm, who's going to the Supreme Court later this year to be heard on a case that basically is going to decide whether trans people, a lower court decided that trans people are covered by Title IX and Title VII, but the Supreme Court has never ruled on that. Just a little bit about Gavin. He's a 17-year-old young man from Virginia who happens to be transgender. A few years ago, he told his parents he was trans, and with their support, he transitioned and went to school and wanted to be treated like all the other young boys at his school. But the school board decided that Gavin was not like all the other boys, and that he should not be able to use the boys' bathroom like all the other boys, and he should have a special bathroom. And I don't know if anyone has seen Hidden Figures. This is a bit of a digression, but stay with me. When I was watching Hidden Figures, if you haven't seen it yet, you must watch it. And this is a little bit of a spoiler, but not really. When I watched Taraji P. Henson's character have to walk 45 minutes each way to a colored bathroom during the Jim Crow era when she was working for NASA to put the first man into space, I couldn't help but think about Gavin Grimm, who had to use a special bathroom that was way out of the way. I couldn't help but think about that relationship between how bathrooms were this contested place for black folks in this country, and now bathrooms are another contested place for trans people. This is not new, but we have to fight this. And I hope everyone will stand with Gavin Grimm when he goes to the Supreme Court later this year. Because this case is a big deal, a lower court, an appellate court, actually sided in Gavin's favor and said that trans people are indeed covered by Title IX. There are other court cases from the EEOC that have decided that trans people are covered by Title IX and Title VII. So this is a really big deal. If this goes against us, this... This is really about, as Chase said, erasing transgender people from public life. And I hope that we all believe that everybody has a right to exist in public life. I mean, the reality is that I don't think they really want to see me in the men's room, right? I mean, they really want that to happen. So it's really about us erasing us from public life. Stories like Gavin, stories like Elon Nettles touch me to my core because I know before the grace of God I could be Elon Nettles. I could be this young person like Gavin fighting for my dignity and for a sense of respect. And what I want to end on, though, after the election last year, there were all these pundits and politicians and journalists writing articles saying that the Progressive Party lost because of identity politics, because I even read articles that said that the Liberal Party sold out women in favor of trans people. And it was really hard to not take that personally, to not think that they were talking about me. And when I think about identity politics, it's really about acknowledging that, unfortunately, as wonderful as I think this country is, it was formed leaving a lot of people out, right? We've had to make amendments to our Constitution because this country was founded on the backs of slaves. Women haven't always had the right to vote. Trans people are systematically and institutionally erased from our country. And these identity politics are really about everybody being included. That's what I think it's about. And so much of the conversations and the ways in which we have these conversations are so deeply disturbing to me. One of the things that Brené Brown says about shame is that empathy is the antidote to shame. That if you put shame in a petri dish and douse it with empathy, you've created an environment that is hostile to shame. And I feel like we have an empathy deficit in this country right now. We have an inability to feel what other people are feeling and put ourselves in each other's shoes. And I really believe that so much of the work that we have to do is creating empathy and acknowledging our own trauma and the trauma that other folks might have. And I think so much of a phrase that I love that I heard a few years ago is hurt people hurt people. And I believe that that's what's going on now. A lot of people are in a lot of pain and a lot of people are hurting. And we don't always know what to do with that hurt and that pain. And so we take it out on each other. But I believe that if we can create and cultivate more empathy and compassion for each other, we can begin to have these conversations across difference with more love and empathy. So I'd like to charge each and every one of you this evening as you leave here and go back into your communities to have these difficult conversations across difference, but have them with love and empathy. Have them towards getting to a better understanding of who the other person is, where they're coming from, and ultimately to a better understanding of who you are. Thank you so much.
What advice would you give to parents of K-12 children to support their identities and paths?
There's a lot of support for parents and trans kids out there now. The PFLAG has an amazing transgender ally resource that I always suggest for people, and there's a lot of support out there. I think support groups have been really useful for me as a trans person and for trans kids. They're wonderful camps. If you do your research for trans kids, that are amazing. I really wanted to go to one last year, but my schedule just didn't allow. So I think it's about getting as much information as possible, believing your trans kid when they say they are who they are, and then reach out to other parents and find support groups for your kids. So there's lots of resources out there, just avail yourselves. But love your kid and believe them when they say they are who they are. And note too, and what I do need to say this is that hormones are reversible. So if a kid, usually we know, but for whatever reason they decide that they're not trans, they just can stop taking medication and then the puberty will happen if they haven't had any surgery. So for trans kids who know they are for sure, this medication allows them to, I hate the word pass. Those are deeply problematic terms. But it helps them to live more authentically. Puberty, is a rough time and a horrible thing for trans people, what happens to us and with the hormones and stuff. So just know that all that medication is reversible if the kid decides later on that they want to live in the gender they were assigned at birth. Alrighty?
How can students in our position make change happen in an environment where the government seems to be exerting an increased amount of power?
We have to stay engaged and we have to call and write our legislators. We have, and when the calling and the emailing and the snail mail, we should do that too. Flood them. When that doesn't work, we have to continue to take to the streets. Let that be a beacon of light for each and every one of us to know that we can let our voices be heard and let everybody know that we will not be silent, that we will not let justice be taken away from us. We will not let our rights be taken away. Stay vocal, stay aware, stay active. Alrighty? I love you. See you, Boulder. I love each and every one of you. Thank you so much. Thank you. You're wonderful.
That was Laverne Cox on transgender visibility. She spoke at the University of Colorado in Boulder. Laverne Cox is an actor and leading LGBTQ advocate. She's one of the stars of the highly acclaimed Netflix series Orange is the New Black. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and part of the nonprofit media education organization, Rise Up. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the media, such as Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, Angela Davis, Arun Gupta, Richard Wolf, Medea Benjamin, Naomi Klein, and Chris Hedges. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. The Kronos Quartet performs our theme music from Pieces of Africa. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.